I'd like to bring the House Judiciary Committee to order on 1/14 on Friday, April 6, 2001. For the record, present are Representatives Meyer, Coghill, Rookberg, and James. We have a quorum to do business. On today's calendar, number one, we will not be taking up House Bill 179, Minors Consuming Possession, until Monday. And that, in deference to Representative Berkowitz, he's got a major amendment that we want to bring before the committee at that time. On today's calendar, we have HB 123, DNA Database, House Bill 121, Charitable Gift Annuities, House Bill 125, Unlawful Viewing, House Bill 196, Right of Action for Illegal Separation, and House Bill 120, Disclosure of Criminal Records, if we can get to it. We, for the committee's information, the public's information, we have a number of bills scheduled for Monday also. But because of that and the Easter break, we've been working with everybody to try to set up a time for a meeting. The only time I can divine that we can possibly get a quorum to do business would be Tuesday after the meeting with Congressman Young. I know there's an oil and gas committee hearing at that time at 5 p.m. But we only have one member that would be on that committee, I believe, Representative Ogun. And if the committee doesn't want to lynch me, I'd like to have a meeting for maybe a couple hours on Tuesday evening. Representative Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, what time would that be approximately? Because I believe Labor and Commerce is meeting Tuesday at 3 o'clock for an hour.
Right, but this would be after that and after the meeting with Congressman Young. So I'm contemplating, and that's
going to be
approximately 5 o'clock.
No more than 2 hours?
I agree.
Can you tell me I can leave at a certain time and that's over?
And if there's further testimony to be taken, I would certainly grant you that privilege, Madam Majority Leader, and I would understand entirely. But it might give us an opportunity to take some public testimony for the record and dispose of a few bills that we are, well, I'm sure, behind on. And the chances are it probably will be Senate Bill 103, possibly, after we deal with, see if it's 105, deal with the sponsor, excuse me. Oh, is that other hot piece of number we have Monday, right? Okay. Well, with that, let's take up our calendar and try to deal with it as expeditiously as possible. And first up, we have Representative Murkowski on 143. And welcome to the committee, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's wonderful to be back.
Oh, welcome back to your old committee, huh?
Yeah. It's different on this side. They all say that, but it really is. I appreciate the committee taking the time to hear not only this bill, but the next one that is up for you is also mine. But I have introduced House Bill 143, which relates to Alaska's DNA database. It is somewhat familiar to those of you that were around last year. We did have a DNA database update in the last legislative session. However, we did not address the issue of including burglary in the list of those that we would collect samples from. And so what I'm suggesting in House Bill 143 is that we expand the DNA database to include the samples from the convicted burglars. So currently, in our statutes, we are able to collect DNA samples from those convicted of crimes against a person, such as assault, rape, kidnapping, murder, child sexual abuse, robbery, stalking, indecent exposure, extortion, coercion, and first-degree arson. What this would do is add burglary to the list. And the reason that I am suggesting that we do this is the statistics that are out there, and you'll probably hear argument as to the numbers, but the statistics that we have seen prove that 50% of burglars go on to commit violent crimes. And there's a correlation or a tie here. That burglary as a crime of convenience basically leads to other violent crimes. So if we can get the identification from those that are committing the crime of burglary, we think that we will aid in the ability to identify and solve and hopefully possibly even prevent certain violent crimes. You will be hearing testimony this afternoon from George Taft, who's the director of the Crime Lab. I don't know if all of you have had the opportunity to visit the Crime Lab recently, but if you haven't, that's a fascinating tour, and George and his crew can take you through how the DNA Crime Lab is working and how they go about entering all this data. We are told that they are ready to go and can handle the processing of these increased samples, and I'm hopeful that Mr. Taft will speak to that. We do have Mr. Del Smith, who will be speaking to this, as well as Mr. Taft, as to the particulars as to how it happens. So without going into the specifics, I'll let them do it, and happy to answer any specific questions regarding the bill that you have in front of you.
Reverend Murkowski, is Mr. Taft online or in the audience? Or?
He should be online.
Yeah, just not. Mr. Taft,
yes.
Are you?
This is George Taft.
Okay, just checking to see if you're there, sir. I didn't have an indication. With that, are there any questions of the sponsor? Yeah, let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Kukesh. Lisa, I see by our list, and looking at the various other states in this very interesting chart that's in the back of the book, mm-hmm. that we've covered everything but burglary and other felonies in our statute. So is that your understanding of it?
That is correct, yes.
Right.
And if you'll look down through that list, it's not so easy on this, but I've got some other charts that we didn't include in the committee's packet that essentially show how the various states are dealing with expansion to their DNA databases. All states require DNA samples for sex offenders. There's 35 states that require DNA samples for murder and assault and battery, and Alaska is included in that, and 24 states now that require DNA samples for burglary. And that is something that is more and more states are looking at to include burglary in that list of violent crimes.
Okay, 24. This chart here says 18.
24. Let me see. It should be 24. I'm just wondering. This is June of 2000. So
it's an older one.
It's an older listing, yeah.
So that clearly shows a trend of other states adopting the same standard that you're proposing.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
With that, we will go on. Mr. Taft, why don't we go to you, and if you could give us your name and affiliation, sir, and testimony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murkowski, this is George Taft, Director of the State Crime Laboratory. We are prepared to handle this workload if this bill is passed. Matter of fact, there was a number mentioned of 24 states, and since that figure has recently been increased to 26 states that now have burglary.
We better hurry up and move this bill.
So we are performing the latest DNA testing called STR, short tandem repeats, which does in fact identify individuals in a range of 1 in a billion. So it is a very specific process and a very accurate process that we do have. And it's the latest of any technique that is available. And we do have that online. So I would be happy to answer any questions that anyone would have.
Any questions of Mr. Taft? Seeing that, thank you very much for taking the time, Mr. Taft, to testify on this important legislation.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to hear from Deputy Chief Mark Mew in Anchorage, sir. Are you available, Chief Mew?
Mr. Chairman, we are here. I have with me also Officer McKinnon from my department, who's sort of our point man on this project, so I'm glad to talk to you folks about general policy issues.
Could you speak up just a little bit, Chief?
Sure, I'm ready to go. Do you want me to start talking?
Go for it.
Okay. The Anchorage Police Department is very enthusiastic about this bill. We were enthusiastic about the precursor, which I think was a couple of years ago. We wanted burglary at the time, but settled for the bill in its current version, for the law in its current version. This is our second run, I think, at getting burglary included. We have an interest in generating as large of a database of criminals as we can, and we see a direct relationship between burglary and other crimes. We're aware of a variety of different numbers from a variety of different studies using different methodologies, but all of which correlate burglars with other crimes, and in particular, I'm thinking of sexual assaults right now. So we feel that being able to include burglars who are prolific in our community in the DNA database will help us stop serial criminals down the road early in their careers, save taxpayer money, and shorten our investigation. I think it's a good tool. And I won't. I'll just stop there, I guess, for the moment. I think there probably will be lots of questions for the police department, both here and public safety. And so maybe in some time, I'll just stand by for questions.
We do have a couple of questions for you, Chief. Representative James N. Meyer.
Yeah, I think, thank you, and my question has to do, I think that the previous testifier gave that number and I didn't get it picked up, is the calculated percentage of folks who do other crimes after being a burglar. What is that number that you have?
I am aware of three different numbers from three different jurisdictions. I've been told, although I haven't read this, I've been told that Florida is looking somewhere around 25%, I think was the figure I heard. I'm aware of an FBI study that used different methodology where they interviewed serial rapists and came up with a figure of closer to 50% of serial rapists that is committed property crimes, specifically burglary, beforehand. We made some effort to calculate this here in Alaska. Our number was quite a bit lower than that. We think it's because we keep the juvenile records separate from the adult records, and so we weren't picking up those people who had burglary convictions who were juveniles who later became adults and went on to commit violent crimes. We're working right now with the Department of Juvenile Justice to see if we can backtrack some of those names and better statistics. But right now, that statistic is somewhere down around. I think Del Smith is there, maybe can help me, but it's lower than 50%, if I recall.
Good follow up.
So there are different different numbers depending on the methodology you use. I think 25% is probably pretty good in terms of burglars that, or rapists that have prior burglary convictions.
Follow up
on that, because I, in my accounting background, I have a little difficulty trying to establish that percentage if you're figuring out how many of the more serious crimes have previously done burglaries, as opposed to counting how many burglaries turn out to be violent criminals. I don't know that necessarily going one way or the other gets the same answer. Do you have a response on that?
Would you say that again for me?
Well, there's two ways of counting this. If you, and I don't know that you can count it that way, but it seems to me like if you count the burglaries and then count the number of those burglaries that go into doing worse crimes, or if you count the people who are caught doing worse crimes, how many of them ever did burglaries, you might get two different numbers.
Right. Well, what we have to do in order to make this work is you have to count the individuals, not the number of crimes. We have lots of burglaries. We don't know who the perpetrator are. And so what you have to do is look at the people who you have convicted of these violent crimes. And then you have to track those individual criminal histories back through time to see how many of them had convictions for burglary. Now, we're talking convictions, so we want an apples-to-apples comparison. We're not going to compare people who were charged with burglary against people who were convicted of rape, or people who were charged with burglary but pled guilty to trespass and vandalism. So there's different ways you can do this depending on your methodology, and that's why it's difficult to compare one state to the next if you don't know what to use. Were they comparing burglary convictions against all violent criminals or against rapists? Was their definition of rape, their statute, the same as ours? Were you talking convictions or charges? There's all these things seem subtle to the lay person, but they can widely affect the results of your study. We're trying to come up with an apples-to-apples comparison right now, but our data is coming in as fast as you guys are holding hearings, so I can't nail down a number for you. I apologize for that.
Well, I just, as one follow-up, I understand your difficulty in trying to analyze this because you can only analyze it going backwards. You can't analyze it going forward because there's no way to do that at this point in time. And, of course, we're taking some legislation here that goes just takes that assumption forward. And so, it's difficult to see whether you get the same response one way or the other. Thank you.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative James pretty much asked my question. I was basing my question on a handout that Representative Murkowski has in our package. It's a study done in Virginia that showed that 40% of the men who were ultimately arrested for rape began their criminal careers with property crimes such as burglary and petty theft. And so my question was going to be, if we had similar idea what how this would track in Alaska.
Representative Meyer. Anecdotally, I think we're right in there. What you just said was that 40-some percent had prior property crimes, such as burglary.
And petty theft,
FBI said 50% had property crimes, including those such as burglary. But you got to be careful because property crimes include more than just burglary. So I think that we're the same as all the other states.
Right. Okay.
I'm just unable right now to prove it to you with a hard number.
Right. Thank you.
Chief Mew, if one benefit of having this evidence available is that it actually can help the potential defendant if, in fact, he's innocent as much as convict him. Is that true?
It's true. It's a two-edged sword. You see people being released from prison after having served lengthy sentences. You read about that in the paper all the time because DNA technology is now available.
Well,
it's an objective test.
Has the APD found that to be the case, and has that helped you in your investigation?
We use DNA all the time, particularly it's valuable in sexual assault. It's good physical evidence that can break an alibi or help you get a confession. It certainly brings the issue. What it does in the case of sexual assault is that it used to be a matter of proving whether or not sex occurred to begin with. Now it's usually a matter just of proving whether or not it was consensual. The first part of the argument is pretty much settled by the DNA. And of course, it also helps in the homicides for obvious reasons. Believe it or not, it can even help us in burglary cases because burglars typically cut themselves on glass, or often do, and leave blood behind. So we may have even serial burglars haven't graduated other crimes. We may have them in the database today, and 2 years from now, they leave blood behind at the scene. We may close up even our own burglary cases with technology.
Representative Coghlan, do you have a question?
Yes, I'll probably ask this question of Mr. Smith as well, but you brought up an interesting point on standards and definitions, and other states may call something burglary that we don't in our statute. And I'm just wondering, since we're going to be collecting information, there is, to me, a privacy wall that we need to really protect and make sure that we're not going to misuse this. And right now, I don't have any fear that our state is going to misuse it. But then we're this generation, and we are going to have another generation coming up, and we're going to have a lot of information. And we could change the definition of burglary. But at this point in our history, could there be people that could inadvertently be caught up because of this definition of burglary who will have DNA samples collected who really shouldn't be in that system?
This is a question for me in Anchorage.
Yes, sir.
Our definition of burglary here, I think, is fairly consistent with traditional burglary definitions. You have to enter or remain illegally with the intent to commit a crime. It's much higher than just vandalizing something or just stealing something. It's not stealing hubcaps off a car. It's not shoplifting out of a store that's open to the public. It's a fairly high level of crime. I don't see, and if you're charged with burglary, but for convenience, but to avoid the necessity of the trial, the DA allows you to plead guilty to something lesser, such as trespass or theft or vandalism. We're not going to be collecting a sample under this law. You have to have the conviction for burglary, not the charge. Unless the legislature wants to change that down the road, that's what we're asking for, and that's what will be held to. It's a fairly high standard.
Yeah, and that's what I want to make sure that's on the record as we're talking about this, because that is a concern whenever we start going in this direction, really expanding a definition. I think it's important that it's very clear that the hurdle is high on conviction. Thank you very much.
The hurdle is high on conviction. That casts a narrower net. The charging with burglary, you'd be catching an awful lot of people. By requiring conviction, not only does that narrow the number of people, but it raises the burden of proof. Get there, I think it's pretty restricted.
Very good. Thank you very much, Chief. Officer McKinnon, did you have anything that you wish to add?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I had a few points I just wanted to make. It's just that, you know, law enforcement is tasked with balancing many public issues, and specifically we're tasked with balancing public safety along with liberty for all. To the contrary, some opponents of this House bill may only be tasked with maybe balancing one of those, such as liberty. And House Bill 143 meets both of these challenges. It enhances law enforcement's ability to promote and preserve the public safety by enhancing and furthering leads in criminal investigations. In addition, House Bill 143 balances those who have been falsely convicted of crimes they have not committed. I think Chief Mute tapped on that just real quickly. I have a document here. It says that 24 states have taken steps to enact similar legislation as this one, House Bill 143. And according to at least one study conducted by the National Institute of Justice, it indicated that violent crimes such as sexual assault are the most expensive on our society, considering all the factors of medical and mental care, loss of productivity, and decreased quality of life. They estimated the average cost of one of these crimes per episode is nearly $87,000. With the enactment of House Bill 143, a suspect's DNA, if it were into the registry, quite possibly could lessen the damage to an individual citizen or, in fact, reduce the cost on the public government. And I guess that I'll end it there.
Any questions for Officer McKinnon? Seeing none, thank you very much for your APD's representation to today's hearing. With that, I'd like to go off the net to Jennifer Ruttinger from the ACLU. Jennifer, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jennifer Ruttinger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union. The Alaska Civil Liberties Union is a statewide organization. Our mission is to defend and protect the guarantees of individual liberty found in the Bill of Rights and in the Alaska Constitution. And we hear every week, almost daily, in fact, from people statewide who write to us and call us and email us with various concerns regarding civil liberties, and that's a very broad term. I would say that by far, the biggest category of cases in the 4 years that I've been the director here that are brought to our attention are people concerned about the government's demand for more and more personal information from them, whether it is genetic information or social security information or background checks or whatever the case may be. By far, personal privacy is very big among Alaskans. And so it's really that I want to focus on today. First of all, the Alaska Civil Liberties Union doesn't doubt that the sponsors of both Senate Bill 99 and House Bill 143 have good intentions. And we certainly don't question the accuracy of DNA in identification. Nor do we question the value of DNA to be used to exonerate the innocent. And in fact, we are advocating in states all across the country and at the federal level that whenever someone is convicted of a death penalty crime, a capital crime, DNA, if it was at the crime scene, should be allowed the testing before they're put to death. We certainly don't dispute its value in that, and therefore we wouldn't oppose voluntary collection of DNA. If somebody's innocent, they will probably want, and their lawyer, their public defender, whatever, who's representing them, should ask for a DNA test. But what we're looking at with House Bill 143 is mandatory forced collection of DNA. And so the first question that we have to ask ourselves is it justified in Alaska? We're not talking about taking DNA from burglars in Florida or Virginia. We're talking about taking DNA from people convicted in Alaska. We started out with sex offenders, as did most or all states. With sex offenders, it's different because sex offenders, A, typically leave DNA at the crime scene, and B, tend to be recidivists. I think it's an 80% or a little more than 80% recidivist rate, repeat offenders. So that it makes sense that if you take the DNA from someone convicted of sex offense, that down the road, first of all, you'll be able to identify them and convict them for that crime, and down the road, if they're 80% likely to be a repeat offender, law enforcement is more likely to nab them, and that seems to be justified. And we were told by the federal government when they started this and by the states that here's the justification with sex offenses, and whether we completely agreed or not, we bought into the argument that it was justified. Then the line moves, and the line keeps moving. And so we have seen DNA collection moving from sex offenses to all violent crimes, and in Alaska it is currently very broad, it's all personal crimes. And in other states, it's gone into property crimes, like burglary, and then you start getting into states that are taking it from anyone who's arrested for a crime, not convicted. And finally, there have been proposals by Rudy Giuliani, and Janet Reno thought this might have some credibility, of taking DNA from newborns. The line keeps moving, and every time that you consider moving that line, we respectfully urge the committee to ask yourself whether it's justified. In Alaska, it's not 40% or 25% or 50%. The only data we have to go on says that only 6% of burglars, of the people from whom you're taking DNA, do go on to commit a violent crime later. 6% is a far cry. That means 94% do not. And this isn't like a fingerprint. I think we also have to look at what we are seizing from a human being. DNA, unlike fingerprinting, reveals information beyond identification. It gives the government control over a great deal of personal, private information, not only about the person you get the DNA from, the sample source, but from everyone related to that person by blood. Information about some 4,000 genetic conditions and diseases, ethnicity, family relationships, family history. This is the kind of information that belongs to the person, not the government. and you've got to really question whether it's justified. And beyond that, as we're constantly finding new things that we can learn from DNA, geneticists are already thinking that we might be able to detect sexual orientation, tendency for substance abuse, so-called criminal tendencies, and the theory of the aggression gene. It may sound Orwellian, but it's true, and it's constantly developing. So this isn't like taking a fingerprint. And I know that what gets confusing for folks, I've been talking about this quite a lot, what gets confusing is that there's two different kinds of data that are taken from the DNA. There's something that looks like a barcode. This is what's entered into the national database, CODIS, the Combined Index.
Ms. Redinger, could you...
I'm sorry?
We have your written testimony. Could you try to wrap it up? We don't need a lesson in what a DNA molecule looks like.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the 13 specific genetic markers taken from the DNA chain that are put in CODIS, that is like a genetic fingerprint. Right now, with today's technology, the only information you can get from that barcode that goes in the database, is identification and maybe gender. But what the ACLU and what Alaskans are largely concerned about is the other set of data, the drop of blood, the drop of saliva, the sample source itself, which there is nothing in federal law, nothing in Alaska law that requires that this sample ever be destroyed. So we would urge you, if you are going to move this bill, we would wonder if the sponsor would consider amending it so that once the testing is completed and the data is entered in the database, and we all know it's 99.9% accurate, get rid of the drop of blood, get rid of the saliva, the hair, the tissue, because it's the information in that sample that is the potential invasion of privacy that has so many people concerned in Alaska. And since you do have my written testimony, with that, I thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to speak, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And any questions, Representative James?
Yeah, I just have a problem. We just heard testimony on this percentage, which is totally a long ways from what you have, and I was wondering, where did you get your information?
Well, perhaps Mr. Smith can speak to this, because I got my information from Senator Randy Phillips. And he was very clear about the information, and he said that the person who told him that was Mr. Smith, and I know that he's going to testify. This is the best information that I have, and the only data that we have right now to go on.
One follow-up, please.
Well, I just say that you should have put a footnote citing Senator Randy Phillips. Would have helped the committee. Yeah, Representative James.
Yeah, thank you. I just have one follow-up here, and I certainly understand your position on our liberties, which are so precious to all of us. But when I think about burglars and catching these guys, whether they go on to some worse crime or not, and having that opportunity protects my liberty, I believe, in being able to live safely in my home and on the streets. You know, I think that is probably one of the most important things that we have of our liberty here.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond? Would that be okay?
Shortly.
Okay,
quickly.
Thank you. I'll be very good. Through the chair, Representative James, I mean, we certainly agree with you. And the problem is that the person has been convicted of burglary, so they're already going to do time. And now you're taking DNA. So the argument here is that taking the DNA is supposed to help law enforcement track them in the future once they're out of prison and back in society with the theory that they will commit a future crime. But if in Alaska, all we know right now is that only that 94% of them will not commit a future crime, this doesn't actually do much to give you or me or the citizens peace of mind. This is simply part of a national movement that the FBI is pushing to build a national database. They want as many samples as possible and as many markers as possible entered into their database.
Thank you, Ms. Redinger. I will just take notice that I appreciate your comments on page 2 that the DNA can also prove the innocence of a suspect, preventing terrible miscarriages of justice. And DNA can even be used to correct wrongful convictions based on an erroneous identification. And I take your point. With that, I'd like to go on to take testimony from Mr. Butkane, followed by Mr. Smith, and that'll conclude that. First. Okay. Deputy Commissioner Smith, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to save you for wrap-up.
Well, I'll still wait.
We'll wrap
him
up.
For the record, my name is Del Smith. I'm Deputy Commissioner, Department of Public Safety, I think. Relative to, I have been in front of this committee last year on, as the sponsor of this particular bill indicated and talked about it. Let me just cut to a couple of the questions that have come up. The 6% that I told Senator Phillips is an accurate number that I told him. What that amounts to, of the 3,000 roughly people that we have taken DNA samples from since January 1st of 1996 that fall under the mandatory taking of DNA, 6% of them have a burglary conviction previously. That is information that you should consider in your deliberations, but it is not scientific by any stretch of the imagination. It does not mean, as far as I'm concerned, that 94% didn't. These are convicted individuals. We've got a lot of unsolved burglaries out there, probably about 85% in my experience in my life in investigations of burglaries never get solved. But that being so, these are numbers that you probably should consider. 44% in Virginia is a number that I was told, 52% in Florida. I mean, you should consider these, but I don't know that we ought to live or die on what the percentage is. The other thing that kicks in the state of Alaska here, as I think was referenced earlier, and I think my brethren at APD could certainly back that up. Substantial amount of burglaries were committed and have been committed and probably continue to be committed by people under 18 years of age who do not end up, for the most part, with a criminal history that we can check our database against. We're trying to figure out a way to do that now to come up with a better number, but simply unable to do it right at the moment. And one other point I'd like to make is there was a case in the past couple of years that, based on what we knew, probable cause would have arrested this person and drug them in for a particularly bad crime in Anchorage. And based on the DNA sampling that we were able to do and compare, we did not arrest this individual. And that's the kind of thing I want to do. I do not want to submit somebody to arrest. Not a pleasant experience. And if I can avoid that by having DNA that heads us off and heads us in the right direction, that's what I want to do. And as far as I'm concerned, that is guarding the freedom of the public. I support the bill, obviously. I think it is an important step forward. It is convicted burglars. No matter what the number is, there was a APRN radio program a few weeks ago that I happened to send and get the tape for and the transcription of that program. And what the gentleman said from Virginia, I think, is if you don't want to do this, then you're probably giving somebody one free sexual assault. I don't know, but it's certainly a possibility that they do go on. Not all burglars are breaking in to get your piggy bank. Lots of the burglaries are probably based on an attempt to get into a house for reasons that got little to do with taking of money or your piggy bank or your guns. So for that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Jane.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, or whether it's kind of a comment, but a question, it appears to me that there might be some deterrent, particularly in people who are under 18, doing these crimes when they had to give up their DNA. Do you think that would have any effect on now they know that's a gotcha, that if they do go on to do some other crime, they're bound to be caught or pretty likely to be caught? Do you think it would be any deterrent at all on the young folks?
Through the chair, Representative James, I'd like to think so, but I'm not entirely sure that thought process enters into it. I would probably think that they would be much more careful on what they might leave at the crime scene.
Well, that would help.
It would help to the extent that if they didn't commit the crime, yes.
Further questions of the Deputy Commissioner? You hit on the point I wanted to make, and I appreciate that, the example of how it can be the double-edged sword here. With that, Mr. Buckhannon, do you want to make a comment? Very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Robert Buckhannon. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Juvenile Justice. We are here in support of House Bill 143 as well. We have approximately 600 burglary referrals to the juvenile system per year, and of that, approximately 200 to 300 are adjudicated delinquent on burglary. We don't adjudicate every child a burglar because of various extenuating circumstances. A case in point, a young person in a village may go into someone's home to get their jug of whiskey from underneath the sink. Technically, that meets the qualifications or criteria for a burglary. But as you piece all of this together, what it really is more akin to when you've got a 14 or 15-year-old is a criminal trespass. So we're much more likely in those kinds of cases to adjudicate the young person of a lesser serious offense. And it seems appropriate to us in some of those circumstances. That would be contrasted to the couple of teenagers who skip school one day and sit in their car at the end of the cul-de-sac and watch people go off to work, go up to the door, ring the doorbell, get no response, and then bust the door in, and then ransack the house and remove valuables and so on. That's a burglary in the first degree, and those are the type of things that we try to adjudicate, holding kids to a higher standard of conduct and expectation. So when we adjudicate someone for a burglary in the first degree, it isn't just a simple thing. We're talking about young people who have taken really actions that have committed the most serious of property offenses. It is a pretty bold and daring move to invade someone's residence, someone's castle, if you will. It is not an uncommon factor for kids to go into homes at night while the home is occupied. There, when I've talked to kids that have done that sort of thing, they get some sort of thrill out of doing this sort of thing with someone sitting there in bed. That's scary to me. We're not talking about people who are innocent little jaywalkers. We're talking about people who have lost any of the reasonable sense about what is an appropriate social boundary. So when we adjudicate a young person of a burglary, we are talking about finding someone having committed a real serious offense against the sanctity and the dignity of a person, their property, and the safety of the community. So we're talking about a class of offender that isn't like the rest of us. Taking a DNA sample from them is giving us an opportunity to have something on file that we can use later in terms of our public safety efforts and our ability to solve crimes and make sure that we hold offenders accountable. I was concerned about the use of information. A few years ago, the legislature compelled us to share delinquency information with schools, and I was initially resistant to that, because I was afraid that teachers and schools would misuse information about a kid's theft behaviors or assault behaviors, criminal behaviors. But what I have found, as we have shared information with schools, is that they have used it appropriately. They hold kids accountable. I've actually found that that was one of the best things that we did in terms of opening up some of the delinquency system to let other people know what we're doing with these kids so that another set of eyes could hold those kids accountable to a standard of conduct that we all agree to. If the people who have this information are misusing it, that's where we need to intervene. So that if I, as a juvenile probation officer, am not respecting the confidentiality rights of a delinquent, then you hold me accountable for misuse of that information, but you don't stop me from collecting that information or sharing that information with people who can make better decisions and take more appropriate action because they have it. That would be the same thing with people in our crime lab. If for some reason their procedures are such that they allow people to access information that they shouldn't have, then hold them accountable for violating the protocols and violating those rights. That would be an answer rather than to deprive the justice system of the use of a valuable tool that helps solve crimes and keep the community safe. If we were to enact this bill, we would anticipate that there would be approximately 200 or so more DNA samples that we would submit to the state crime lab for adjudicated delinquents who have committed the crime of burglary. We have a system in place that would allow us to do that without any programmatic or fiscal impact on our system. The sampling is a very simple mouth swab test. It's taken by our field probation officers as well as our youth facility staff. It's sealed and then sent off to the crime lab where it's classified, recorded, and so on. It's a simple and effective process, and again, the department supports this committee substitute.
Very good, Representative Jane.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. I was very interested in what you had to say, and one of the things that I wanted to ask you then is, because I believe there could be some deterrent in this action, especially on youth folks. And I understand some of these are pretty callous from the very beginning and don't really think too much about what they're going to be doing. But what would be your process then if you were in charge of this juvenile in this condition and they were to then have given the DNA? Would you have a plan that would make it perfectly clear to them what kind of evidence they're leaving behind and what their future could hold if they were to get into some other bad trouble?
Through the chair, Representative James, yes. We do that now with juvenile disclosure. Not all cases are automatically subject to mandatory public disclosure. But in our discussions of those offenses that are not subject to mandatory disclosure, we talk about your next offense will trigger a series of events which could subject you to being published in the newspaper. For kids who are on kind of that moral boundary, that does help them stay within the boundaries sometimes. Explaining that to a young person who has committed a burglary, to say, you know, you've got a chance. You can choose to walk this way or that way, but if you walk this way, everything will be fine and taking your DNA really won't matter down the road. But it is on file so that if you walk the other way, it will make it easier for us to find you and hold you accountable. So communicating that message to them, I think, has some value.
Yeah, thank you, and I appreciate that, because in my all the foster children that I had in Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, the first ones that I took was from the Hillcrest School for Girls, and one of the things that they provided with me is the full file on these students, and so knowing that, you're talking about the teachers knowing that, gave me the wonderful to a much more successful foster care program. So I think that it is very important for people down the line to understand that, but I think it's very important for those students to know that we know. So that's important.
Representative Calico.
This question may be for Mr. Del Smith or for the crime lab folks. Probably start with Jim.
Buckman is now a witness here.
Any
questions, Mr. Buckman? Thank you, sir. Representative Calico.
May I ask a question of Deputy Commissioner Del Smith, sir?
Sure. Now that Mr. Butkane's done, you can ask anybody you want.
Thank you.
Ask your question, and we'll figure out who we're going to direct it to.
The issue of security becomes an issue, and really there's three things. Crime lab, the types of information that you might get from DNA, the security, and what would be the liability for misuse. Can you describe that to us?
Chair, Representative Coghill, the samples initially were blood samples, I think somebody mentioned, and are now a swab of the saliva. So they're stored in a secure, in the crime lab, in secure cold frozen storage. The only people having access to them are the people within the DNA program when they come in, they're in there, and Chris Beheim is on here, or excuse me, George Taft is on. He wants specifics about that. But the samples are brought in, stored. Part of that is taken and creates the so-called barcode that we referred to before, the 13 loci. But the sample does remain, which is a DNA sample, which presumably could ultimately do all the things that some folks have indicated. Currently is a misdemeanor crime to do anything other than what the law says that you're supposed to do with that for criminal justice purposes, in a trial or presentation of evidence, and those kinds of things. And I am not aware of any problems nationally, certainly not locally in this state about it. I mean, it is a very important thing that we hold that secure, prevent anybody from accessing it except for the purposes it's intended for. I mean, we're a law enforcement agency. We absolutely believe that we have a responsibility to use those for only what we collect information for. I don't know that it, I hope that answers your question, but if not, I'll try to do a little bit.
That I just wanted the general parameters lined up. In fact, it is a misdemeanor for misuse, and I didn't doubt that, but I hadn't seen anything technically in my study on this. So, thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Butkin, real quickly, do you fingerprint juveniles that have been adjudicated as delinquent?
Mr. Chairman, the law allows us to fingerprint juveniles in the same manner in which adults are fingerprinted, but no, I'm afraid we do not have the capacity to fingerprint every juvenile delinquent. We do try to fingerprint those that have been adjudicated delinquent through a formal court process, as well as those that are booked into our youth facilities for any offense. And based on that, we are probably fingerprinting in the neighborhood of 30% to 40% of our youth.
But there's no statutory or legal restriction.
That is correct.
Thank you. Ms. Representative Murkowski. Perhaps I neglected to indicate to the committee that we had a committee substitute, and you forgot to remind me.
And
so could you tell us the difference? We have the F version blank in front of us. Apparently you're deleting sections 2 of the bill.
Yes.
You rewrote it. Could you explain to the committee that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and unfortunately I don't have a copy of the original bill that was filed, but what we did was eliminated the section. If you read the letter to, thank you, if you read the letter from the Alaska Civil Liberties, they made reference to this this expansion that my bill apparently did, that they indicate that it would allow law enforcement to demand DNA, and I'm reading directly from the ACLU letter, demand DNA samples from anyone related to a missing person if law enforcement articulates even a remote possibility. Essentially, what happened was there was a section that was eliminated or deleted because it referred to the ability, as I understand it, to identify missing persons. And Mr. Smith, if you can come up and assist me with this. As I understand, we don't have the capability in this state to do it, and it didn't make sense to include such language in the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Smith.
In talking about the bill beforehand when it was being drafted, I thought there's a national effort to do that, to allow the missing person and those kind of things to get into database. I thought we needed legislation to allow that here. It turns out since this was drafted, the FBI is creating that and will voluntarily let people put into it, and they're going to maintain it so we do not do it in the DNA registry that I understood we needed to do for the state of Alaska and the other states. My understanding is it's a national one, and if people have their, it's, for lack of another term, sort of reverse paternity. I mean, if I had a child that was missing, my understanding is that they could take a DNA sample from me, put it into this database if I wanted it to be there, and the remains that you find around the country and different things that are unidentifiable, they would run that against that in hopes of closing my loop eventually sometime, that I could find out what happened to my missing person, child, or whatever. That's my understanding of what they're trying to do. I originally thought we needed, ours would be the point of entry for the state, and it turns out that that's not the case. It would be run by the FBI and taken, handled totally through them, is my absolute understanding of it, and this became unnecessary, and I communicated that to the sponsor.
Very good. Mm-hmm. So recommendation is to adopt the CF then. Representative Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, I know you have a heavy schedule, so I'd like to go ahead and move this.
Representative James.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we put CS draft number F, House 143, as CS before us as the working document.
Any objections to adopting the F version? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Meyer? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee substitute F with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections to moving 143? Seeing none, so moved. Thank you very much. Representative Murkowski, thank you very much, everybody. You want to change, take a brief at ease to change files. We have before us the committee substitute for House Bill 121, Labor and Commerce, and the bill sponsor, Representative Murkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What we're talking about with House Bill 121 is charitable gift annuities. And the question was asked to me before the committee, well, what is one? Essentially, it is a contractual agreement between a charity and an individual. If I should decide that I want to make a donation to the qualified judiciary committee charity, I can make a donation. And with this qualified charitable annuity, I would be able to essentially get a revenue stream or get a payout or a monthly payment to me, guaranteed, and be able to take a tax deduction for my charitable contribution. And essentially what we are doing with this legislation is we are giving notice or setting up a notice system to the Division of Insurance that a qualified charitable annuity is out there and that they have accepted these annuities. What House Bill 121 does is essentially define and clarify what a gift annuity is. It spells out that this is not insurance. We actually deliberated about this a little bit in Labor and Commerce. There is no representation that this is covered through any form of insurance through the state. The Division of Insurance is not saying we're regulating this, and the donor needs to understand that, in fact, there really is no regulation over this. It is purely a notice type of requirement. But what it helps, or what it does from a consumer point of view, is let you know that the charity that you are dealing with is a legitimate, bona fide charity. There are minimum cash requirements that the charity has to meet. It's a $300,000 minimum cash requirement. They have to have been in operation for a period of years, and it gives the consumer some assurance, if you will, that these are legitimate charities. Beyond that, though, it doesn't do much in terms of regulation. You have in your packets some. It was almost like a brochure from the National Heritage, I believe it was the National Heritage Foundation, which is a charitable gift annuity, kind of walking you through how the process might work. And we do have in Alaska just a very small handful of established charitable gift annuities set up. You'll hear from Providence Foundation, and I think that they will help explain how the process works specifically for them. The legislation that you have before you is adopted from an NAIC model, and it is a model that has been adopted in 30 states to just basically set out this is how the notification process works, and this is why we're doing it. So those are the key points. We did get a little bit hung up in labor and commerce in terms of is this some kind of a regulation on the charities, and it's not. It is purely a notification process to the division. We should have available Gloria Glover from the Division of Insurance, who will speak to that component of it in terms of what the Division of Insurance's role is. With that, Mr. Chair, if you'd like greater clarification from me on any aspect of the bill, happy to do that. But as I say, we should have at least one individual online from Providence Foundation.
Representative James.
Well, thank you. I was really confused by what you explained on this, but I think maybe I kind of might get what it is now. But is it that if I wanted to give some money, say $100,000 I have, and I'm going to invest it somewhere, mm-hmm. somehow, some way, and I could maybe qualify to give this $100,000 to a charity that would qualify for this thing, and then they turn around and they pay me a monthly amount back mm-hmm. for the rest of my life, whatever mm-hmm. that is, and that's not taxable to me, the money that's coming back, or is it?
There is, Mr. Calder can probably give you more information in terms of how that tax deduction works to you. And in looking at some of the information that we have, it's tax deductible to a point. And then after that, and I don't know, quite honestly, Representative James, I don't know what that point is.
That's my interest in this, because first of all, I'm trying to see the advantage for the giver. I can see the advantage for the recipient of it.
We do have a couple of folks online.
I don't see the advantage.
And just very briefly, the advantage to the donor is twofold. It allows you to make a charitable donation for which you get a deduction. And it also allows you to earn a revenue stream off of your investment at a rate that's set by actuarial standards. So you can make the donation and still receive a return on your investment and get a deduction.
Okay. I understand the intent. I just have to think how it's going to work. Okay.
And it's probably best to listen to those that are actually doing it in practice.
We do have Mr. Selby online, and perhaps Mr. Minton, I'm not sure.
Mr. Calder as well, maybe?
Why don't we...
Yes, I'm online. John Calder is probably here too as well.
Ms. Calder, and is Mr. Minton online?
I don't believe so.
Is Mr. Calder and Mr. Selby, are you available?
Yes. Okay. I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. We're just checking there. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and take that testimony, if you'd like, Ms. Johnstein, and it helps clarify a little bit.
I think that would be helpful.
Any order?
Mr.
Selby, sir, would you please identify yourself, your affiliation, and give us your testimony, sir?
Hi, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerome Selby. I'm an employee of the Providence Health Assistance here in Alaska. And we had requested this legislation to be considered, and we really appreciate you folks taking up and giving it careful consideration. Nice job with it today. We basically were looking at the fact that Providence is one of a handful of organizations in the state who are doing the plan giving program, and John is really the guy who can give you that, because he does it firsthand and can really answer some of the previous questions and give you some of the details. But we are a participant with the national effort on plan giving, and as a result of that, those folks came up with this draft legislation, which they called model legislation, partly with the idea that these things would be handled pretty uniformly across the country. And so
Partly for that reason, we requested that you folks take that up and put it on the record here in Alaska. Also, for the reasons that were identified by Representative Murkowski earlier, just in terms of making it clear and giving the Commissioner of Insurance a way of dealing with this, and helping to clarify for folks that, you know, this is not an insurance policy, not a guarantee by the state of Alaska of anything. And so there's some positive things as far as not letting misunderstanding fester out in the real world there. And then the rest of it is just that it's healthy from our perspective for there to be a good light of day test, if you will, that folks do notify the state that they're going to be in this business, so that if an elderly couple, for example, gets contacted by someone who maybe isn't a little bit unscrupulous, trying to do something inappropriate, that they have an opportunity to check with the state insurance commissioner and say, hey, have you ever heard of Providence Foundation? At that point in time, you know, while there's no commitment from the state, I think you can't understate the value to an elderly couple or an elderly person to have the reassurance that, yes, the state is aware that this company is out there and is in this business. I think takes a lot of pressure off and probably a great deal of relief for that individual. So for all of those reasons, we think it would be good for you folks to put this legislation into place. It doesn't really change anything that Providence has been doing. We've been functioning pretty much in accord with everything that's in this bill for years anyway. But it does then level the playing field for everybody. And just for your information, we have contacted the other folks that we know of who are doing plan giving programs in the state, and we have their unanimous support for you folks to put this bill into place. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions, but probably John and his detail would be answer a lot of those questions.
Okay, given that, why don't we go to Mr. Calder then? And have his testimony and make him available for the designated question answer. Ms. Calder, sir?
Yes, I'm John Calder. I'm the director of Major Plant Gift for the Providence Alaska Foundation right here in Anchorage. I'm part of the Providence Health System in Alaska. I wanted just to reaffirm the testimony already. We felt this was a good bill to support the charitable efforts here in Anchorage and in Alaska. Already spelled out by our representative, Murkowski, is that we feel that it really defines and clarifies what a gift annuity is, so that it is known, and it also assures the insurance commissioner that this is not it's not commercial insurance. This bill has been favorable. It's been passed over in 30 states in the lower 48. So I think we have a good track record there. But it does again clarify it. It provides minimum cash requirements. Charity has to be in existence for a number of years. So we feel that it's a good bill. It also tells donors that it gives them a notice that this is not under any laws of the insurance laws. It's simply a charitable gift annuity, and that we have notified the Division of Insurance that we are issuing this gift annuity. So with that, perhaps I can answer specific questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's Representative James. Would you be so kind as to explain to me the benefit of the giver in this process?
Okay, benefit for the giver.
Yes.
Well, I think the benefit are these. With all planned gift options to the donor, the reason why this came into being almost 100 years ago was that it essentially allows the donor to make a gift, but then in return it guarantees that the donor it guarantees lifetime income to the donor. So
the donor has the satisfaction of making a gift which is meaningful to that particular donor, but also obviously can give them the security of having a lifetime income, so they're able to make the gift and also get something back in return. And then also, as far as the practical benefits goes, as was stated earlier, they receive a charitable deduction that's based on the actuarial tables that are given by the National Committee on Gift Annuities. They get partial tax-free income, and basically a charity charitable gift defined is really a contract between the donor and the charity. Since it's part gift and part return of income to the donor, they get partial tax-free income as well. And so for those benefits, they're able to make a gift, they get a charitable deduction, they get part of tax-free income, and they also get guaranteed income for the rest of their life.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any kind of an indication that you could indicate to me that I could relate to the relationship of the cash back to the cash that you've donated?
If I understand your question, is there a relationship between the amount of cash the donor gives and also the cash that's given back to the donor? I would answer that question, and basically is that it's calculated on the rate set out by the National Committee on Gift Annuity. When I do these, I simply enter the amount. $10,000 or $5,000, whatever the amount is, I put the person's charitable gift annuities are based on age. So the higher the age, the greater rate that the person receives. But when I enter that in and put those numbers in, on the average, I would say as a general, sort of like as a norm, the person will get back, the charitable deduction will probably be equal to about, generally about half the gift. So if you made a $10,000 gift, he would probably get back, he or she would probably get back a charitable deduction of about $4,000 to $5,000. Also the partial tax-free income, if the person is getting, let's say, $2,000 a year back. Probably a good portion of that, I would say, normally, again, based on the age, the person likely is to get back more than 50% is going to be partially tax-free. Of course, I have to qualify that, because if it's a younger age, that relationship is taken into account, the age of the donor.
Mr. Calder, would that tax-free income be because it's return of principal because of the age?
The partial tax-free income is, the donor gets partial tax-free income because a gift annuity is basically a part gift and part return of income. And so IRS feels, of course, these is all governed by IRS regulations, but because it is part gift, then the person is able to, then the income that they get back is going to be partially tax-free. They're going to get credit for making a gift and also get back income from the gift.
So your return on investment could actually be higher percentage-wise if you have the imputed rate of return by your tax savings calculated into it. Okay. So it's kind of you're doing good works and get partially tax exempt bond money back. You could look at it that way.
Right. You're getting some of the money that you get back, some will be taxable, but a good portion will be tax free.
No more marketing allowed. Representative James.
Well, just to follow up on this. It seems to me, however, that the only reason why people would, not that it's such a good deal for the donor,
as it is for the receiver, but it, you would want to do it because it's a good enough deal that you feel good about giving this money away.
Correct, correct. I wholeheartedly agree. I would be most, I feel that it's most important when I visit with donors, while the tax benefits are certainly there and they're certainly advantageous to it, a donor most often gives to a charity because he or she believes what the organization is doing. It helps people, it feeds them, it clothes them. Whatever their belief is about giving a gift, that is the reason why a lot of people make a charitable donation. And a gift annuity basically really is only, historically even, it came into being, is that it allows a person to make a meaningful gift. But then as a corollary benefit, it gives them some help in return with some guaranteed income. So the tax benefits are there, but they're not certainly the primary reason why a person makes the gift.
Further questions? Ms. Calder. Ms. Glover, are you online, ma'am?
Yes, I am.
Would you care to make any testimony?
Comments.
Could you speak up just a little bit, please?
Excuse me. I would like to make a brief comment. I'm Gloria Glover with the Alaska Division of Insurance. This bill, we are supportive of the Committee's Institute for House Bill 121. It will provide notice to the division of entities that are issuing these types of annuities, and we will maintain a list so that we can respond to any public requests for information as to who's on that list. It does provide some enforcement if donors are not notified or not provided the notice that this bill requires. Further beyond that, however, we do not see that we are regulating these products or these entities, and that's reflected in the fiscal note, the zero fiscal note that you have. That's all my comments. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Glover, why is your division have the oversight rather than banking and securities? Is an annuity normally the jurisdiction of Division of Insurance as opposed to an investment vehicle by banking and securities?
Chairman Roper, that has been a question over the years. There is some overlap regarding securities and insurance when it comes to annuities. We do have a definition of annuities in our statute, in the insurance statute. We have worked with banking on these issues. It's my understanding that currently it is in the Division of Insurance jurisdiction.
So you have the responsibility in terms of annuity oversight then, generally?
Correct.
Because they're usually a vehicle used by insurance companies as a marketing tool and investment for their clients.
Correct.
And they're based on actuarial life expectancies in large part, right?
That's correct.
Okay, any further questions of Ms. Glover? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on House Bill 121? Is anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 121? Seeing none, we'll close the public testimony on this bill. Any wrap-up?
I don't have any wrap-up, Mr. Chair. I think that it was helpful to get the information that Representative James wanted. So.
Representative Cogdell.
You said in the Labor and Commerce, was there any discussion on the annuity notification for, say, an insolvency issue, if there was bad management or anything like that?
Probably the closest that we got to that, Representative Coghill, was in, you'll note that there is a minimum cash requirement of $300,000 in assets of the charity, and a recognition that the assets of the charity are essentially the backup to the guaranteed annuity.
I recognize that probably most of the things would be lined up in a contract. I'm just wondering if we're going to go and try and notify if there's a falling below the limit so we're not going to regulate it is what I'm getting at.
Correct.
That's what the notice says in the bill, that they're not regulated, and we amended it to put it in bold type in the contract, informing the consumer that they're not regulated by the state of Alaska.
Well, and I appreciate that. However, there's going to be some notification to the donors. And I was just wondering.
That is the notification. Yeah. If they make a donation, they have to sign a contract.
Right. That's the only notification. I want to make that real abundantly clear.
And that's why we even amended it to make sure it was a bold type in the contract.
Yeah.
Okay. That's my amendment.
Okay. A darn good one.
Absolutely.
It was.
Further discussion. Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Mr. Chairman, since you and I both have heard this in Labor and Commerce, I have no questions. So I would move CS House Bill 121 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a fine committee. It's nice
to
know that some committees are moving.
We might be a little bit late for the next meeting.
You'll be excused.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take a brief at ease. Bill 125, and we're blessed with the presence of a representative of Cott's office, Ms. Henderson.
Yes, my name is Denise Henderson, and I am aide to Representative Cott. We're presenting House Bill 125 to the Judiciary Committee this afternoon. House 25 basically will ban a practice which has become commonly known as upskirting or downblousing. Basically, what this bill will do, it will amend Alaska State Statute 968 by creating a special civil damage provision that will benefit people who have been unlawfully viewed or photographed. It also creates a new crime that will make it illegal to surreptitiously view or photograph someone in the interior of a room without their consent. It would make this a Class A misdemeanor. It basically amends our existing crime of indecent viewing by including the viewing of undergarments as well as unclothed body parts. I'm sure everyone is aware that with the modern technology of the internet, it's made this practice more common with websites posting and buying pictures from high-tech peeping toms and telling people where they can buy the type of equipment needed in order to do this. They not only promote this practice, but they encourage it. And this bill, House Bill 125, will not only protect the privacy of the residents of the state of Alaska, but it will prohibit any type of monetary gain to be made by the perpetrators of crimes of this nature.
So this creates both a civil cause of action and an expansion of the misdemeanor provision?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Don't we already have a, let's see, is 1161 already improper viewing? Are we adding to that? And then we have a new subsection or a new section here? Or
we do have, there is 1161, it is, but this kind of, it amends it. In the 1161 right now, there is no provision for civil damages. And what 125 will do, it allows for civil damages in these types of cases.
Any Any questions of the sponsor?
I'm just having some memories.
Didn't we do this one before?
No, I'm just thinking of something.
Oh.
When I was in high school.
Oh.
We thought it was pretty funny.
Representative Meyer.
Yeah, I'm probably stretching this too far, but like if you take a picture of someone in a swimsuit, that would be, that's not covered under this. I mean, that would be okay. Is that correct?
Well, I it would depend in accordance to this bill. It would depend on the situation, the circumstances. I think if you were to take a picture of someone in their, if I mean hypothetically speaking, if I were in my home, and you were outside, and you took a picture of me in my home, I think something like that could be covered under this, because when I'm in my home, you know, I'm in a realm where I have a right to privacy, and it's being done without my consent,
right,
or without my knowledge.
But if I'm in your home and you're having a, let's say we live in we don't live in California.
We wish we lived in California.
Yeah, you were having a hot tub party, and I took a picture of you in your swimsuit, and then it ended up on my website. That would be okay because you knew I took the picture.
Exactly, because you're right there, and I'm aware of the fact that you're taking the picture. With my being aware of you taking the picture, then that gives me the right to say, you know, no, I'd prefer that you didn't, or, you know.
And probably if I use that on my website, then I should ask your permission first.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Representative
James. Mr. Chairman, I'm really happy that I'm finding out that what I was laughing about wouldn't be illegal under this bill.
Would you please elaborate, Representative James?
No, not a word. For the questions of...
I do have a question.
Representative Cagle.
In reading this new section 2, I had to look up surreptitiously. is it necessary to use that word? Is that a legal use that is going to be clear enough?
It's just a word.
I know that.
Well, it certainly has a meaning.
It does have a meaning. All words have meaning.
Well, I mean, I know, but it...
It pretty well defines what we're talking about here, too.
Yeah.
Think of all something right. Else you want to say, the same thing?
Well, it would take more words, so no.
That's why we have bigger words. They have economy of speech words. Yeah, right. The economy of language. When they, word power made easy.
I was going to suggest an amendment. So when we get to it,
we do have, I believe, some people to. We have some folks online to testify, and with the niece's permission, we'd like to hear from Detective Klinkhart. Are you there, sir? Detective Klinkhart? He's stepped away from the phone. Hopefully he was there. Ms. Ruttinger, did you want to testify on this bill?
Images that are not actually involving the use of any human subject, but they look like human beings. And I just want to caution the committee that this bill might be premature. The Supreme Court is going to hear a case in October that asks this very question, whether it is unconstitutional to prohibit the viewing of an image, a computer-generated image, that doesn't involve the use of any human subject. And so I would just let the committee know that that case will be coming up in October. It will be decided next year. And you might want to hold off on the bill just to make sure that you're not flying in the face of a U.S. Supreme Court decision next year. But other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate your time.
Any questions, Ms. Redinger? Thank you for your brevity.
Thank you.
Seeing none. Ms. Henderson, do you want to comment on her testimony?
In speaking with Detective Klinkhart, it's my understanding that he's not on the line, but the detective is very supportive of the bill. Basically, he works in the sex crime division, and he works in a division where they deal with a lot of child pornography, and they have had problems here in Alaska with pictures being sold on the website. I think in Section 3 of the bill, it does go on to explain a little more about a person commits the crime of indecent viewing or photography if, in the state, the person knowingly views or produces a picture of the private exposure of the genital, anus, so on and so forth, or the undergarments. And basically, we added that because, as you know, there have been a couple of instances, even here in our state, where there have been cameras placed in the girls' locker room and videotapes of young women dressing and undressing and in their undergarments.
Let me interrupt you right there. Is the primary reason because, in the fact, there wasn't any real nudity shown? There was
exactly.
There was undergarments and so forth. So therefore, the other versions of the crime of indecent viewing couldn't be pursued because they had their underwear on. Is that the point here?
Yes.
Okay.
And also, Mr. Chair, one of the main things that we're looking at is, you know, we already have this on in statute, but one of the main things that we were looking at in this bill is setting a precedent so that people do not have the opportunity to have any type of monetary gain off of this. I mean, now it's easy. It's become too easy to go on to various websites and sell, you know, photographs. And we just want to see that, you know, there are some type of civil provisions set up so that people don't have to suffer while others gain monetarily from this type of behavior.
Do we have an internet cops?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say we needed the judiciary.
Detective.
Yes, or we wouldn't be doing our job.
Do a lot of
okay.
That.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I was not listening. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on House Bill 143? Mr. Buttkanser.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Robert Buttkane with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Juvenile Justice. We do have some concerns with this bill. As a juvenile probation officer responsible for deciding whether or not a police report has got probable cause to proceed on taking action against a juvenile offender, we might have problems with the words surreptitious as it's used in this bill. While there is a legal definition for that word in Black's Law Dictionary and circumstance, it might be difficult to really separate out the criminals from the non-criminals. The way the bill is written, you could have a scenario where I am in someone's living room and I am trying to sneak a photograph of the facial surprise of someone opening a present. They might not know that I'm actually snapping the picture and not even know that I took the picture until I email it to someone a few days later and say, wasn't that neat that Jane got this present? Now, while I don't think that that would necessarily be prosecuted, it might be investigated and sent to us if Jane was annoyed that such and so person took their photograph. Additionally, the Department of Health and Social Services engages in a number of activities where we photograph people as a routine course of business. When we admit people to the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, we photograph them so we can make sure that their medical records has a picture of them, so we make sure we're giving the right medication to the person who actually looks like the person in the photographic image. Those people are not always voluntarily giving us permission to take their picture, and sometimes they are not even aware that the photograph has been taken. In medical facilities where someone comes in a comatose state, again, we are taking a photograph without the person's permission, and then we are using that and circulating that among people who have to have access to that photograph to do their normal course of business. This bill does exclude some specific uses of photographs for security surveillance, for law enforcement, but it does not provide explicit exclusions for the normal course of business in healthcare professions, hospitals, or juvenile corrections facilities. And if this bill moves forward, I'd suggest that we might consider that as an amendment so that there wouldn't be any question that people doing their job would not be subject.